How did Bobby's leave?
It's the Jeff Hayden Show. Let's go.
Good evening. This is the Committee of Health, Human Services, and Housing. We are reconvening at 5:30 on Monday, March 16th, and we are beginning with Senate File 892, Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members. I have Senate File 892, which will minimize the barriers to admission to a very important mental health service that we have available in Minnesota. When an individual is experiencing a mental health crisis and feels they need a safe place where they can stay temporarily to cope with the crisis, a service called Mental Health Crisis Residential Service is available in many Minnesota counties. This service provides individuals with access to mental health services in a facility where they can stay for a few days until their mental health crisis is under control. Senate File 892 streamlines the process that providers of this service have to go through to be reimbursed for providing the services, and in doing so will increase access to this critical service for Minnesotans experiencing a mental health crisis. Right now, individuals and providers have to go through a number of time-consuming steps to access payments for this service, and because this is meant to be a temporary service, the steps are often not completed by the time the individual leaves the program. This results in providers not being reimbursed for the service. Enactment of the streamlining changes proposed in this bill will allow individuals and providers to focus on the most important task at hand, supporting the individual to work through their mental health crisis instead of having to focus on complicated and time-consuming eligibility paperwork. At this time, I'd like to introduce Ani Simons on behalf of the mental health providers to explain in more detail why this legislation is needed.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Hayden. Is this Ms. Simmons?
Yes.
Yes. Ani Simmons, would you introduce yourself to the committee, where you're from, and begin your testimony?
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Ani Simons, and I'm here tonight representing the Mental Health Providers Association of Minnesota. I worked hard to trim down the testimony. I know you have a lot of really important bills to hear tonight, but just wanted to briefly describe why we feel this bill is very important. As Senator Hayden so well described, Mental Health Crisis Residential Services is a critical program where individuals can access services and supports for a short time while they're dealing with a mental health crisis. But unfortunately, the current process for seeking reimbursement for these services doesn't align very well with the structure of how the service is provided, and as a result, it's difficult and time-consuming for providers to be reimbursed for the service. Currently, when an individual seeks out this service, the provider works with them to fill out an application form to begin the process of determining eligibility and securing payment for the service. That application form is then sent to the county, and the county can take weeks or longer to get back to the provider, and it's often at times with a request for further information, further documentation such as bank statements and other income verification documents. The issue is that the average stay in mental health crisis residential treatment services is around 5 days, so by the time the provider hears back from the county about the additional verification paperwork that's needed, that individual has often moved on and is no longer receiving services with the provider. As a result of the system, the client is denied eligibility and coverage for the service, not because they didn't necessarily meet and wouldn't meet the eligibility requirements, but because the provider was unable to follow up with them at the time when they found out what additional documentation was needed. And therefore, providers are often left uncompensated for providing the service to the individuals that were very likely eligible for it. So what the bill before you would do is it would basically say that if someone is receiving medical assistance, it's going to be assumed that they are eligible for the group residential housing funding stream, which is the room and board funding stream for this service. When an individual would access the service, the provider would verify that the person is receiving medical assistance. They then would fill out paperwork or work with the county to let them know that they were going to begin providing mental health crisis residential services to the individual, and the county could then move forward with reimbursement for the service. In doing that, the bill would minimize barriers to admission to this critical service by streamlining these eligibility steps so that providers could more easily be reimbursed for the service, and then this would allow the individual and the provider to focus at the issue at hand, addressing the mental health crisis. Thank you for your consideration, and we would ask for your support of Senate File 892.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there others that you've brought with you that would like to speak to this, Senator Hayden?
Madam Chair, no, I don't have any other testifiers. I don't know if there are others in the audience, though.
Excuse me. So he's not coming. Right. Are there others in the audience who wish to speak to this bill? All right. Seeing no one, I'll bring it in to the committee itself. Are there any questions or concerns expressed from the committee? Senator Hayden.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 892 to the Finance Committee.
Any further discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Okay, Senator Hayden, you now have Senate File 928, modifying eligibility for group residential housing.
Yes, Madam Chair, I have Senate File 928.
Oops, excuse me,
I guess I have an author's amendment, an A1 delete all amendment that I'd like to move to get the bill in the shape that I'd like it to be.
Do we have the delete all? Yes, okay. Senator Hayden offers the A1 delete all amendment to Senate File 892, if I got the right numbers in front of me. 928. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Now
thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment is a result of close work with Hennepin County and the Department of Human Services. The amendment better clarifies the intent of the original bill. I believe counsel can walk us through the relevant changes.
Madam Chair and members, the A1 amendment to Senate File 928. A lot of these sections may look familiar as they were pulled from Senate File 825, with the exception of the housing assistance provisions that are in 825. Sections 1 and 2 impose background studies on GRH providers and supplementary services providers. And Section 3 is technical. Sections 4 through 12 modify existing definitions in the group residential housing chapter of law and add necessary definitions for the provisions, subsequent provisions in the amendment. And then I'll just point out the major things. In Section 13, Subdivision 1A, it requires a professional certification in order to get a GRH rate above the MSA equivalent. Subdivision 2A imposes minimum staffing qualifications. Subdivision 2B on page 7 makes the agreements between the agencies and the GRH and supplementary service providers uniform. And Subdivision 2C are the background study requirements. Subdivision 2D on page 8 allows the commissioner or gives the commissioner the authority to suspend or terminate an agreement under certain circumstances. And those are the major changes in those sections. Section 14 on page 11 is just technical. And then Section 15 allows the supplementary services for people who have experienced long-term homelessness. Section 17 changes the way they report income. The recipients with earned income will report every 6 months instead of every month. And then Section 18 is just technical. And Section 19 is actually what the original bill tried to accomplish, which is for a person who is on group residential housing who has earned income, The prospective budgeting must be used, and the income, the increase in income is not will not affect the person's eligibility for GRH until the month following the reporting month.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. White, I think she's covered substantially kind of what the bill does as it relates to GRH to create an environment in which folks that are receiving GRH can kind of have a timely budgeting process where there isn't such a cliff, and that there is a way in which there are ways in which as they earn income, they're just not immediately kind of taken out of it. So I think that Ms. White has done a good job. I do have our good friend who we seem to see a lot more here in this committee, Commissioner Higgins, who's been a friend of this committee for a long time, who will kind of just give you a summary of what the work that they're doing, in particular in Hennepin County, and why this work is so important.
Well, thank you very much. It's so nice to see you here, Commissioner Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I don't know
like
if we should be calling you Senator Higgins, or there's always this discussion about which term to use. I think commissioner is a higher term than senator, so we'll go with that.
Okay.
But before you begin, I just want to, you know, what there's a lot of language in this bill, and this is a policy committee, so I just want to highlight, I want to lift up in the conversation what it is that we're changing here and why we're changing it. And I think, Senator Hayden, you began to talk about that mm-hmm. there's a drop-off that can occur that doesn't allow people to have the housing sustained for a period of time until they're able to find more stable housing.
So
would you highlight that again, what it is that is that was not a policy before and would be a policy now with the passage of this bill?
So let me go through the highlights of what I have in my notes, and then Commissioner Higgins can help us. It will make reporting of earned income for clients in GRH easier by moving from monthly to six-month reporting. So that time frame will be longer, which is an administrative issue, and it helps the clients. It also makes it easier for GRH providers to have a more predictable and timely income source so it doesn't fluctuate from month to month. It saves money for the state and the county by reducing the number of times they must process changes in the income reports for clients. The bill provides quality assurance measures such as requiring background check for GRH staff, maintaining the housing code, and provider services required and paid by the state as a condition of the GRH payment. Also, because of the service rate varies based on the level of service being provided, the bill allows payments for the housing and service portion of GRH to be separated. And so essentially, it reduces cost and rewards clients when they're able to work to do so. So that's kind of what we're doing in this package of things that are here. And I think that Senator Higgins can also kind of go in a little more in depth on how this works on the ground level.
And I understand that the language in the bill is clear. It stipulates that the enrollee can have a GRH grant for 6 months as a transition period until they can obtain an independent living situation. So they can continue to get this housing grant while they're in a transition, even though they've become employed.
Right, because we're going to look at the budgeting 6 months out as opposed to every single month.
All right.
And that's often done in other housing programs. When I ran a program, you know, a Section 8 program, we did it over a year. But this allows them 6 months.
Commissioner Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is one of Hennepin County's priorities because we think it will improve outcomes for our clients in all the ways that Senator Hayden was just explaining. Hennepin Health is one of the few Medicaid providers who are reinvesting savings in providing complex clients with assistance to reenter paid employment. Hennepin Health is a safety net, accountable care organization. You've heard of ACOs as you've been talking health policy for several years now. And our ACO is responsible for providing Medicaid benefits to this complex population of adults without dependent children. Because Hennepin Health receives a fixed per member per month payment, it can provide services that will improve members' health that are outside the traditional healthcare roles. And the perceived and real barriers to employment created by the GRH program are significant. We've had probably 6 to 10 clients in the past year who were interested in exploring employment assistance, but decided against it because they feared they would lose their housing. That's a terrible situation to put somebody in. Let me tell you about one of our clients named Sam, who had severe behavioral health issues. We helped him get a job. When he told his GRH provider of his good news that he had a job, he was then told that he'd have to move out immediately since GRH clients weren't allowed to work. He didn't even go to his job. When we followed up and found out what had happened, we met with a GRH provider who said they could do some better training of their staff, but because Sam lost his first job, we then had to help Sam get another job. Another client found himself owing rent when he left his GRH placement because of the confusion of the amount of rent owed and the delay in getting the notice. The notice didn't come until the GRH provider got notice from DHS, which was 4 months after he'd started his job. So this has made it really hard for him to pay the rent that he owes, the back rent, and this also made it impossible for him to get private housing because he's still trying to pay off the old housing. Before he had a job, he had housing but no job. Now he has a job and no housing. So at Hennepin County, we feel that employment helps people become healthier by improving their self-worth, by improving their social connectedness, and raising income and moving clients towards self-sufficiency. You can help us achieve those goals by passing this bill. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Are there any questions from the committee members? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find it hard to get a two-page bill that's turned into a 14-page bill with a delete-all amendment. So I've been trying to keep up here with the testimony and appreciate that. And there's a lot of things that I like to hear and hear about this. But because this just came to our desks, I'm wondering if our council can tell us what it means on Section 4, Subdivision 3, when to receive payment for a group resident rate, the residents must meet certain requirements, new requirements, it appears, Subdivision 2A to 2F. And I'm reading on lines 2.8, 9, and 10. And since we're changing how that reimbursement, the regulations that must be met for residents to receive reimbursement, I'm just wondering what those new requirements are.
Madam Chair and
Ms.
Senator
White?
Nelson, you're on 2.9 to 2.10.
Yes.
And the cross-reference is the requirements under 256I.04, subdivisions 2A to 2F. Those are actually reflected on pages 4 through 9, and they include the uniformity of the agreements between the GRH providers and the county or the agencies, the minimum staff qualifications, the background checks. Oh. It has to do with the program integrity elements that are also in CenFL 825 and have been added to this bill, too.
Thank you. I think that probably answers my question, that they're further fleshed out later in the bill. And then I have one other question, Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
And I noticed that in, and maybe this is somewhere else in the delete all amendment, the language strikes community residential settings for a single adult for foster care. And I'm just wondering if that is a significant. That's on line 2.7 and 2.8. It seems
your question. Your question is why is that eliminated from the group residential housing definition?
Yes. My question is about the language deleting foster care settings or community residential settings from group residential housing?
Madam Chair, we have Christine Davis from DHS here. Maybe she can help us with this.
Welcome, Ms. Davis.
Like just calling you out, sorry.
Did you hear the question?
I did, thank you. Christine Davis from the Department of Human Services. The language strikeout referenced two of the many types of licensed and registered GRH settings, and so it was really just deleting an unnecessary reference where it wasn't all-inclusive of all the settings that GRH pays for. So it was old language when there were fewer settings, and so it was just, it had been updated last year with the 245D changes. So this just deletes it so that it doesn't confuse people to think that those are the only two settings that GRH is found in.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, Commissioner Higgins. On page 12 at the bottom, supplementary rate for certain facilities. I know this isn't the Finance Committee. We're looking at someone who's experienced long-term homeless. There's a differential rate. Can you give me some context as to how much that differential rate would be? What, you know, how we're going to define that going forward, or is that the commissioner has some discretion?
I think Ms. Davis can answer your question.
Ms. Davis?
Senator.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the change on the bottom of page 12 regarding the supplementary service rate for people who have experienced long-term homelessness is replacing a requirement that people relocate out of older homeless shelters that were licensed before December 31st of 1996. So what was happening is people were relocating out of homeless shelters in order to gain eligibility. The original intent was that it was for people who were experiencing long histories of homelessness, but this the state has a long-term homeless criteria defined, which is that the individual has been homeless continuously for 1 year or for four episodes in the last 3 years.
And Senator Benson? Madam Chair, just to follow up, so it would be used for additional job training, health services. I'm just trying to, is it 10% more than someone else, 25% more than a regular client at group residential housing?
So the
Ms. Davis?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, thank you. The standard rate in the state is $483 per person per month. And this would remain the same rate that is used today.
Are there any other questions? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As long as we're on page 12, I noticed that we've, in starting on page 9 through 12, subdivision 3, we take out the moratorium. You take out the county agencies, and you scratch county and go to the word agency. That same thing goes into effect in section 14, beginning on page 11 as well. And as well as subsection B before subsection 4 on page 11. So I guess my question is, you're scratching county, but are you including county in agencies? Is this become a larger, you're shaking your head, yes? I didn't need to answer that question.
Ms. Davis?
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, the reference to agency instead of county is to align with changes referenced in 256P. Last year, there were changes to public assistance programs in the program uniformity changes that, so of agency is now including counties and tribal governments. And so there are now both counties and tribal governments that have GRH agreements, that are authorized to have GRH agreements. So it just allows for either a county or a federally recognized tribal government.
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, a quick follow-up. Then, so it really doesn't change the moratorium on so new beds or new availability for beds, which is really, I think, sad because there's such a need out there. And I'm really appreciative of the fact you're bringing this bill forward, Senator Hayden. It just changes the scope of the responsibility. So my question's answered. I just wish that we would look at adding more beds throughout the system.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. I would also like to ask you, Senator Hayden, or whoever would like to answer the question, with the extension to reporting every 6 months, I think you said, which would allow a continued residential security, and that gives time, I'm assuming from what I'm reading here, for these other resources to be built in the person's life so employment becomes something they want to retain or achieve. And so I was reading about somewhere in here about here on page on page 3, and do I understand then under subdivision 12 professional certification, it's a confusing heading for me because it's described as a statement about an individual's illness, injury or incapacity that is signed by a qualified professional. So I guess it's a professional certifying the needs, as that is, of the person in the housing. It's all about an individual's needs, so the professional certification title is very confusing to me. But I see number one under subdivision 12. During this 6 months period of time, there's an effort to assist the person to find their own home, their own landlord negotiation, and to be able to do that and to access maybe other support programs that would help them afford that housing so they're not discouraged about staying employed. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, I think you have the essence of what we're trying to do.
And on page 9, I see that crisis shelters for battered women and their children are not group residences under this chapter. Is there a reason for that, Ms. Davis?
Madam Chair, those settings are covered under the Department of Public Safety.
Are there any further questions?
So, Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 928 as amended to the Finance Committee.
On Senator Hayden's motion, any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thank you very much,
Madam Chair, members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Should have taken his glasses.
What is talking about? Oh, your day's coming, buddy. You got a couple of funky bills out there. Wait till I get a hold of him.
That was fun.
Wait till I get a hold of him. All I was going to say, this is a Linda Burglar bill. So.
And now, Senator Sharon, Senate File Number 1708, Human Services Community First Services and Supports Program Policy Modifications. Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. This is a portion of the Department of Human Services policy bill that was quite lengthy, and so I pulled it out, if you remember, because it was late in the evening and there was a great deal of detail. So I pulled it out, put it in a separate bill so it could be brought forward for further discussion and clarification by the department. And I have Kara Benson with me from the Minnesota Department of Human Services to describe this section of their policy bill, what its purpose is, what problems are trying to be resolved with it, and what it in fact does.
Senator Sharon, you have an amendment. Would you like?
I do have an amendment.
The A2 amendment. Would you like to take care of that first?
Please, is it the A1 amendment?
A2 amendment. Members, you have the A2 amendment on Senator Sharon's amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes.
So with that, I would turn the microphone over to Ms. Benson to go through the bill to articulate what the objective is here, what the goal is, what the language does to help us achieve that goal, and what policies, we need to be very clear we're supporting with our votes.
Welcome, and please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, my name is Kara Benson. I'm with the Disability Services Division within the Department of Human Services. And briefly, I'd just like to go over some of the policy things that we're trying to accomplish in the changes for this bill. In addition to many technical changes to the bill, in kind of a very high level overview, we're looking at program integrity, participant protections and rights, commissioner's access and sanctions. And under program integrity, we're looking to improve things through training and education of participants at the outset of services regarding program requirements, responsibilities, and consequences for noncompliance, requiring agencies to conduct supervisory visits at a location where CFSS is provided at an established frequency, requiring all supervisory visits be in person when the support worker is a minor, establishing specific elements to be documented for each evaluation of services and the workers, identifying worker training and development requirements and reimbursable activities, creating responsibilities for agencies to assure support worker competency through direct observation and evaluation at the start of the service and additional requirements, required evaluations, authorizing the consultation service provider to intervene when participants to resolve issues of noncompliance with requirements of CFSS, and creating clear authority for CFSS policy staff to require proof of compliance from providers and participants and implement defined consequences for noncompliance. I'm not sure if it would be more beneficial to continue going through the overall changes or if there are questions at each point or what's the preferred method here.
Well, I think that, Madam Chair, I just would like to give some context that CFSS was originally passed as part of Reform 2020 initiative in the 2013 Health and Human Services budget. And this new self-directed home and community-based service, once fully implemented, will replace the personal care assistance program. That's what this bill does. And, of course, it has to, it does require and still requires, we have not achieved federal approval as of yet for this program. But it's very similar to the PCA services in many ways, but it aims to offer more controls, flexibility, responsibility, and choices for those who utilize the service. So most of the changes are technical. The more substantial changes, which I think might be of interest for our discussion, although the person-centered planning process that is implemented in the language of this bill really is emerging from an overall initiative related to allowing persons to have much more control over and decision-making about how the resources that we give them are spent in their care. And rather than having them align specifically with a particular program, the client is able to organize a menu of services, a menu of needs, and hire whom they would like to carry out those services for them. And that's what this bill is about, and that is what it does do. And it has elements in it to make sure that the agencies that provide these services, should a client want to use an agency to help them hire and supervise a client, the terms and the conditions under which that can occur. There's language in here that describes if the person doesn't want an agency to do that, but they want to budget that and manage it themselves, the terms and the conditions and the obligations they have to the state of Minnesota should they choose to organize their CFSS services themselves, and what the reporting requirements are and the oversight requirements. There is discussion in the bill if an agency hires an employee for a client, their obligations to provide supervision and make certain that the competency of the person exists. And there's language in the bill that talks about how frequently and an in-person visit has to occur from an agency to make certain that the provider is, in fact, doing what is expected in the work plan that's developed between the client and the state or the client and the agency. Those are the critical elements that are in the bill, and they are an effort to put into a new model of PCA services that is much more consumer-directed and controlled, while at the same time establishing some criteria for competency and follow-through and expectations of the quality of the service itself. So I think that everything else in the bill is technically describing what I just described. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
So unless you want us to walk through it section by section, I'd open it up for your questions.
Members.
Madam Chair, I don't know, can a bill presenter also be a question asker?
I think so.
I don't know. I've never seen that happen before. But in reviewing the bill, one of the things that I was hoping that we could have more presentation on is one of the issues, I think, of concern in the PCA system as well as in CFSS is that these are vulnerable persons getting services, and they could be services with medication, services with bathing, services with dressing, you know, a variety of services. And these are in-home services. It's very similar to in-home public health nursing services. You go into the home where the person is and provide the services. So, but these are vulnerable adults, typically, that are needing this service. So on the one hand, we want the individual to have as much control as possible over deciding what services and who hire their own employees if they want to do that, or hire an agency to hire that. So it really is on this consumer choice, consumer autonomy side. And then on the other side, we have a vulnerable group of people. So how are we certain that, because these people become very, very dependent on these services to stay in the community, that the provider of those services is competent, is there, shows up on time, does what they're supposed to do. And so it's that portion of it that I read in the language, that there's a requirement for an agency to do a in-person visit 4 times in the first year, and then once a year after that. That's the supervisory responsibility of an agency over the PCA. And I just wanted the department to talk more about why they think that's an adequate amount of supervision, and if there may not be a need to build in some other requirements that an agency call and do a satisfaction survey more frequently in order for an opportunity for a client to communicate outside of the realm of the PC, of the personal care attendant type person, whatever we're calling that now, to report if there is a failure to perform the duties, a question of competency, or a question of feeling of safety or security or exploitation. So I'd like you to talk about that.
Ms. Benson?
Madam Chair, Senators, There are a couple of things that can happen in community first services and supports around that. First, there is the consultation service. This is a service that does not exist right now in the PCA services. The responsibility of the consultation service is to first make sure that the participant understands the models and has significant information to choose between the models. The other piece of that is they're also there to support the participant if such things that they don't agree with are going on. They can report those instances to the consultation service provider. The other piece of this is worker training and development. A participant under either model of the service can purchase extra training for the participant that's laid out in the plan that the participant does create with the consultation service provider. So they can have that extra training that's in the plan that's specific to that participant. In that, as in the qualified professional service and PCA right now, a participant or the agency can request more of those services if they're needed, so they can have more support to get either the training or the information that they need that they believe that they're not getting.
Senator Sharon?
I would just follow up. I am concerned that the initiation of the communication has to come from the client to the consultant, or the client to the agency, or the client to the department. A complaint process has to be developed. That's also in the language of the bill. But the person has to initiate the complaint or seek the consultation. And what I'm saying is I think that should remain in place, but I know with vulnerable people that they may be afraid to make a complaint about a caregiver because they're afraid they'll have to pay a consequence because they still have that caregiver. And so what I'm asking is if there isn't something we might add that requires a contact to the client periodically, not just this face-to-face visit from the agency or from the department, but a call, you know, once a year. In the second year, this is going to be once a year supervisory oversight. I think that's very light, and it depends on the client then creating a contact. And I'm just saying, I think we should strengthen this by adding an obligation on our part, on the department's part, to make random calls or periodic calls to clients to do a satisfaction survey that asks questions, and not only about are you getting the services that you said you were supposed to, do you feel that they're competently prepared, but are you treated respectfully, are you feeling safe and free from an exploitation or from harm. Just like when people come into the doctor's office, we always ask the question, you know, is there anything of the violent nature happening in your home? Or we just do some appraisal of that. And I just would like to see a little more, because I don't want to go on about this, but I like the idea of independence, of growing the independent choice-making of the individual person. But I just cannot get away from the fact that many of these people are vulnerable. And so I think we need to add, I just think it's in our best interest if we add another step in there that requires us to check on their well-being. And I don't know how to do that. I might think about an amendment for that purpose.
Okay. Ms. Benson, do you want to just take that under consideration at the moment, or do you have any response to?
Madam Chair, I think that's something we can take under consideration.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Benson, Senator Hoffman, and Senator Nelson. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Eaton and then Senator Nelson. And so Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, it looked like Senator Eaton and Senator Hoffman might have been to that point. I'm on a different subject, so I would defer perhaps Senator Nelson if they're on that point.
Senator Hoffman or Eaton, is it on that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Benson. I think, Senator Sharon, you're getting to a point. I think these folks still have to meet yearly under, you know, with their plan or their team or their caseworker. You're shaking your head yes means I'm correct on that. If that's the case, then I think you purposely put into that meeting a requirement that says, you know, we're going to spend not talking about, well, how's it going, but rather, you know, let's just really do what you just said, get specific to that satisfaction survey. That way you're getting that feedback, which then becomes a part of that individual's case record or plan or IDT or whatever it is. So I really like what Senator Sharon is saying, and I think there's an avenue for that, and to get specific, and maybe the department comes back with how to make that purposeful and planned, since you meet once a year anyway. So that's just what I'm thinking. So
thank you. Senator Eaton, did you have another comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. I guess I wanted to kind of validate what Senator Sharon's saying in my work in the community. Many people are afraid to turn in their caregiver for fear they'll lose their housing, they'll have to go to the nursing home, they'll, you know, because they're afraid they won't be replaced fast enough and it'll really disrupt their lives. And I've seen some people put up with some pretty terrible situations just because of that fear. They become dependent. They have to have somebody there, and if they know if they do anything that gets that person gone, what are they going to do? And I think there has to be some mechanism for them to feel comfortable that their needs will be taken care of even if the person taking care of them isn't competent. I mean, I've seen it. I think it's a real concern.
Senator Sharon.
This will be the final thing I'll say on this issue is I think that absolutely at the annual meeting that Senator Hoffman is talking about, there should be specific questions about this. But I think a one-time-a-year evaluation of the safety, the person's well-being and safety, and whether or not a person that they've hired is doing their job should be reviewed much, at least by a phone call in the privacy away from the caregiver. If it's an agency-oriented group, then the agency should do it. And if it is where the person is their own agent, then we have to determine who would appropriately assess that. So that's what I'm talking about, above and beyond the one-time-a-year evaluation period.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Benson?
I'll defer, Madam Chair. My question was, is it still an annual evaluation? We've covered that, and so I'll defer.
Oh, that was your only.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Senator Sharon first for bringing this back tonight for discussion. I think it's an important discussion to have, and I really appreciate that. And I also want to support your idea about a greater frequency of feedback from clients. I think it's critically important, and we know that even continual feedback is very critical. We see that in every aspect of all the things that we would do online, for example. Now there's that continual feedback loop that really spurs improvement or spurs people or deters people from behavior that's not so great. Now, we can't have continual feedback. I understand that. But I do think we can have something more than once a year. And so I really support your initiative to change that to greater feedback. And with that in mind, regarding the vulnerability of the clients that we're talking about, the one thing I noticed in looking at the legislation was, you know, some things were just rearranged, so it looks like they were struck out in one place, but I found them later on some other pages, and so that was fine. But there's one piece that I can't find repositioned somewhere else that I think is important, and that is on page 2, line 22, and that's describing a level 1 behavior. And at first I was concerned that was all struck out, but I found it later on page 5. But there's one piece that's not, and that is very important, and that is those with increased vulnerability due to cognitive deficits or socially inappropriate behavior. Is that still included in the bill somewhere? I found the rest of the language that was struck on the bottom of page 2 over on page 5, but I could not find that language about someone who is vulnerable due to cognitive deficits. Where might that be in the language? I'm sure it's not left out. I'm sure it must be in the bill somewhere.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe it is in Subdivision 8, if I recall correctly, but I need to go there myself.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
The rest of the language that was struck from this section was over in page 5. But not the language I'm looking for about the cognitive deficits.
See, since 11-1 behavior. Ms. Benson, we see on page 13.
It's page 13.
Yeah, line 13. Line 22. Senator Nelson, 13:22.
Cool. Yep. Thank you for reassuring me that it didn't disappear. I appreciate that.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much for paying attention to that. This is, you know, there are many people who are
in this program who are not increasingly vulnerable because of cognitive deficits, et cetera. But it is this group that I'm concerned that we pay a lot closer attention to than a review once a year.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson, did you have other questions?
No, that was it. Okay. I found what I needed there. Thank you.
Other members, do you have questions regarding the bill?
I think we've covered it.
Senator Sharon?
So I'll just have one more question, and that is, when can I see language that will accommodate to what I'm describing?
Ms. Benson?
Madam Chair, Senators, that's something we can work on fairly quickly. I hope that will suffice.
This is just a policy bill, so its next stop is on the floor, isn't it? So. Yeah. I guess we'd have to make an amendment either now or to the policy bill on the floor.
Oh, there's another amendment. Or not. Okay. I'm hearing recommended the floor. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to suggest that we put some an amendment on there that requires at least a monthly follow-up to without the caregiver present, that somebody either by phone or in person. That's what we put in place for our vulnerable people who are on case management. Their case managers are required to see them once a month, and we added into their duties to assess for how they were getting along with their caregiver.
So they're having monthly contacts already?
Phone call.
Telling what they did.
Senator Sharon,
do you want to say that?
Oh.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Benson.
Senator, some of the individuals do receive waivered services, so case management is involved. Not all of the individuals, but some of the individuals. So they are receiving some of that support if they are receiving waivered services, but not if they're receiving state plan only services.
So, Senator Wicklund, I'll work on language that assures that there is at least a call in much more frequently for those who are not covered under waivered services, and we'll add that as an amendment on the floor if you'll all support it when we get there and stand up and say yes to the amendment.
Senator Benson, did you have a question or comment?
Madam Chair, it was to Senator Eaton's sort of introduction of an amendment, but since we're going to have alternative language, I'm not going to ask the question.
So
with that, unless there's further questions.
Members, any other questions? Seeing no other questions, Senator Sharon.
1708 be passed and referred to the floor.
As amended?
As amended.
On Senator Sharon's motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're going to have to reconcile the language on the phone.
Thank you. Welcome, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Before you, we have Senate File 1440, which is the Board of Pharmacy Policy Bill, and it deals with the Minnesota Prescription Monitoring Program. And as you know, members, the prescription drug abuse issue continues to be a very serious problem. Over 22 million Americans have a substance use disorder, which is about the same number of Americans with diabetes. And today, with Senator Eaton's bill, Senate File 1410, and Steve's law, I found it amazing that information that you passed out, Senator Eaton. In the month of March 2014 alone, nearly 210,000 prescriptions of opioids were dispensed in Minnesota. That's pretty amazing. So in 2010, directed by the legislature, the Board of Pharmacy launched the Prescription Monitoring Program. And DHS also has the statewide substance abuse program out, which all deal with prescription drug abuse or doctor shopping. In 2014, the legislature also directed the board to develop a report in consultation with the PMP Advisory Task Force that was created at the same time to address that, number one, requiring the use of the PMP by prescribers and pharmacists. Number two, allowing for the use of the PMP database to identify potentially inappropriate prescribing of controlled substances. And number three, to encourage access to appropriate treatment for prescription drug abuse through the PMP. The report was submitted to the legislature in December of 2014. This bill, Senate File 1440, is a lot of those recommendations with a few others. So basically, the summary of the bill is to remove the requirement to report tramadol, which has been moved by the DEA into Schedule 4 of the Controlled Substance Acts. And Senate File 1219, which was heard in Judiciary last week, lines up the state and federal Schedule 1 through 5. So that's good. It also requires prescriptions of gabapentin to be reported by the PMP. And gabapentin is a nerve-related pain drug. It's currently not a controlled substance, but what is happening in central Minnesota and some reports in Mankato is that it's being crushed, ground up, and combined with Suboxone, thank you, and it's being snorted. So a whole new level of how we do use that drug. Section 3 of the bill is probably the most controversial. It removes the provision which requires de-identifying PMP data that is retained beyond 24 months. The data still retained no longer than 4 years, and only the most recent 12 months of data would remain accessible to permissible users of the PMP database. The entire 4-year data would only be accessible to board staff assigned to work with PMP and its contracted vendor. And this information, this data is extremely important for to keep it for 4 years to do a trend analysis. We don't need the Social Security number. There's nothing that deals with that. So it's just data so to make sure that the PMP is working. The next section, Section 4, deals with access to data. And this allows prescribers to access the PMP when providing emergency or medical treatment other than prescribing controlled substances without patient consent and only when it's clinically valid. It also allows pharmacists to access the PMP when providing pharmaceutical care other than dispensing controlled substances. The pharmacist access data when consulted by a prescriber who requests data in accordance with the law. Section 4, the paragraph 5, deals with access to data for other health licensing boards and the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. So when investigating a specific complaint alleging that one of their licensees is impaired by the use of controlled substances or has attempted to fraudulently obtain controlled substances by a doctor shopping or past forged prescriptions or inappropriately prescribing controlled substances, we need access to the data on that. Other boards, the other boards have no access to this data, and this would happen without request, without written request to the PMP staff. Excuse me. Section 4, paragraph C, it talks about the prescriber, and it basically asks the prescriber to a prescriber that has a current registration issued by DEA to register and maintain a user account with PMP. And this, members, was directed by the study that was put into the bill last year. There is no mandated usage on this study for the prescriber. It also requires in this section that every pharmacist licensed by the board and practicing within the state to register and maintain a user account with PMP. And we've found that by simple registration in some other states and not mandatory, that actually the usage of PMP goes up. So the class, and it also in this section classifies the data submitted by the prescriber, pharmacist, and their delegates during the registration application process, other than their name, their license number, and license type, as private data pursuant to Section 13.02, Subdivision 12. So with that, Madam Chair and members, kind of a brief summary of the bill. I have Dr. Cody Weiberg here with me, and he can fill in the blanks and straighten out anything I messed up. Oh, and Madam Chair, I do have an amendment, actually, an oral amendment. Thank you. And it is on page 5, line 22. And this came from the Minnesota Medical Association. It would, in paragraph D, scratch A and put in only. That would read only permissible. And then instead of user, put users identified in paragraph B, and then it goes on. And then on line 23, after the period, after electronically period, insert no other permissible users may directly access the data electronically. No other permissible users may directly access the data electronically. And that satisfies their concerns, and the Board of Pharmacy is fine with those changes. So, Madam, I'd like to move that oral amendment.
Ms. Kavanaugh, could you repeat the oral amendment?
Absolutely. Oh.
Madam Chair and members, on page 5, line 22, strike A and insert only, and strike user and insert users. So it should be only permissible users identified. And on line 23, after the period, insert no other permissible users may directly access the data electronically. I'll let you answer the question. I can
help. And paragraph B defines who is a permissible user.
Right. Mm-hmm. D. B. Right. Madam Chair.
3.
Right.
Senator Benson, do you have a question about the amendment?
I did, Madam Chair. And Senator Rosen, trying to get some context, what brought that issue forward? What problem was the MMA trying to solve?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, I'm Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. When I drafted this year's legislation, I thought that what I drafted in combination with some existing language made it clear that if health licensing boards were going to have access to the data to pursue complaint investigations, that they couldn't have direct access, meaning we would not assign staff of the other health licensing boards a user ID and a password so they could log in and just look at any data they wanted to. Rather, what they would need to do is to submit a request to my PMP staff saying, yes, we have received a bona fide complaint and we need you to run a query for us. And apparently, my drafting must not have been so good because it caused some confusion. So I think this clarifies that only certain types of users, which are basically the prescribers and pharmacists working out with patients, my board staff who have to look at the data to maintain it and to do these data queries, coroners can look at the data. They're the only ones that can have direct access and can have an actual user ID and password. Everyone else who wants data that's allowed to get data has to come through my staff and have us run the queries.
Could you pull your microphone a little closer, Mr. Weiber? Senator Benson, anything further?
I'm just trying to get through paragraph B, it looks like a long list. I'm just, as much as you said, it appears short, so I'm just trying to make sure I'm not missing anything. I have no objections to the amendment. Usually amendments, though, are a sign that there was some trouble, and I'd like to know what we're trying to solve.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, I think it was just really brought to me just to clarify, just to make sure that everybody's okay with it and it was okay with the board.
On the amendment, Senator Rosen offers the oral amendment. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you. Okay, so to the bill itself. Is there anyone here wishing also to testify to this bill? Please come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And I would just like to take you through the bill as far as we see the concerns. So I'd like to just start with line 3.15, where it requires the data or allows the data to be de-identified for that period of time, combined with the line 3.15, which I'm looking at the, summary. Where it says that the PMP staff, which was kind of mentioned, could do a meaningful analysis of the effectiveness. So what I think I'm seeing here is essentially 4 years or more that an individual could be part of a research project. We don't know what kind of analysis this might be, but we do know that they would be analyzed, their use would be analyzed, the doctors would be analyzed as part of this, and it would all be de-identified. We've already heard from people who are concerned about what happens to their information in the system. If you go to line, there are three pieces of this that take away the patient consent regarding how prescribers and pharmacists look at this. One of those is in 3.33 that has to do with the prescribers. 4.8 has to do with the pharmacist, and then 4.9 is the pharmacist helping the prescribers. And in all of these cases, there is no patient consent required. And I know that I heard it stated that this would allow access for emergency only, but if you look at the language on that, starting with 3.33, it says that the prescriber providing other medical treatment for which access to the data may be necessary, and currently it says, and the patient has consented to access the submitted data. So there's no, what does may be necessary mean? I think it's terribly broad without the individual being able to access, I mean, being able to consent. It doesn't say anything about emergency. And I wonder if, this makes it so broad that anyone that was a prescriber could access this at any time for any reason. And that's the same for the pharmacist as well. And then the doctor could always ask the pharmacist, or some other kind of provider could ask the pharmacist to help them as well. All of this without any patient consent, all for very broad purposes. We completely disagree with taking the consent provision away. Next, I would draw your attention to starting at line 3.8, where it removes the word substantiate. Line 4.20, where it talks about a complaint, and you can look at the data as long as there's a complaint, as well as 5.12, which also talks about a complaint. As I understood this information service, when it started, this was a way to have physicians make sure that if there was a patient doctor shopping, they would be able to figure it out by looking at the data. But instead, I think what we're coming up to here is this is becoming an enforcement mechanism where we can go looking for people without a search warrant. And if you take away the word substantiate, certainly the whole idea is to substantiate and to use this system to substantiate abuse or crime or whatever they're happening to be looking for. So I believe we are significantly expanding the purpose of this pharmaceutical monitoring system by those three sections of the bill. And the last thing that I want to draw your attention to is the required registration. No prescriber or pharmacist who doesn't use the system should be required to register. We don't need to have systems where the state requires people to register who aren't even part of the system. That's just bad to do, wrong to do. We could all be starting to be required to register for all sorts of things just in case we might happen to use that system. That's a bad example to set for state systems. And the only other thing I would add is there, because I didn't look it up in advance, and I'm sure that your legal staff knows, is there actually a remedy for individuals whose data has been accessed? And are we, by taking out the consent, completely eliminating the ability of anyone to go after the people who choose to look at their information whenever it may be necessary, as defined by whoever wants to look at it at the time? So those are my comments. We certainly oppose the bill. Don't support what is happening here.
Oh, thank you. Ms. Brace, would you repeat again? I was trying to summarize in my mind the things that you were focused on. You're talking about disagreeing with the removal of the patient consent.
Right.
And
yes, Mr. Madam Chair.
And you're concerned about the removal of the term substantiated, which is a higher level of requirement in order to justify. The third thing you talked about had something to do with required registration. Would you go through that again?
The requirement for registration, which is in starting on page 5.16, our concern about that is that there are a lot of systems in state government where maybe at some point in time we may choose to use them. But to require every practitioner who doesn't even use the system to register with the state sets a bad precedent for what individuals are required to do under government mandate. So we see it as a bad precedent moving forward to telling people that even if you aren't going to use the system, we're requiring you to register for it. Considering all of this hunting as well that could be going on here, it's entirely possible that those who show that they have not accessed could be looked at. I have no idea. But the fact of the matter is, if you're not going to use the system, you shouldn't be required to register for the system, and probably to update your registration any time that you change, because I'm sure that would probably be required as well.
Okay, thank you. And then the last was, is there a remedy for those whose data is reviewed inappropriately?
Yes, is there currently a remedy today? Now, today we have consent and we have de-identification, and now this bill would take away the de-identification, allow for more research and analysis of all the individuals whose names are in there, and as well would take away their consent requirements for any use that's not about prescribing these controlled substances. So my question is, do we have it now, and how are we getting rid of those protections by the language of this law?
Thank you.
Or this bill.
Are there any questions for this testifier? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, it's for Dr. Weiberg. Page 5, every pharmacist licensed by the board and practicing within the state shall register and maintain a user account. Even if they don't use it, Ms. Braze asked the question, what if they never put anything in it? I guess I'm curious as to why. You already have a comprehensive list of everybody. Why do they need an account if they're not going to use it?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, if I might put this in...
Mr. Weiberg.
Yeah, put this in the perspective of the last legislative session as well.
I've got to ask you to speak up a little bit.
Sorry.
Speak into the microphone. Thank you.
All right, sorry. Let me just put this, if I could, into the context of the work that we've done over the last couple of legislative sessions. When my PMP manager and I have come over and talked to legislators, both senators and representatives, Republicans and Democrats. One of the things that we often heard was PMP is a good program, but you know what? We ought to require use. We ought to require pharmacists and prescribers to use the system. We ended up instead doing the study. And as part of the study, we looked at what other states do. There are actually very few. There are a lot of states that talk about they have required use, but when you look at it, there are a lot of exceptions in there. But in those states, because they have this requirement to use the system, the presumption is that anyone who might prescribe a controlled substance, any pharmacist who might dispense a controlled substance, is going to have to register for the program, because if those exceptions aren't met, they're expected to use the data. We also found other states that, rather than requiring use, required registration. And so we thought this was a better approach because, as Senator Rosen mentioned, in those states that formally had no required registration and then put it in place, the use of the PMP went up quite a bit, because now people understood that it was really there. And despite our outreach efforts, and they've been extensive, there are apparently still prescribers and pharmacists that aren't aware that the PMP exists. So this was actually, from the board's perspective, and I think the perspective of the members of the advisory task force, something of a compromise against the what we were told by many, many different legislators over the last couple of years, that there ought to be mandated use of the system. And sometimes it was every time you were going to prescribe, every time you were going to dispense, it needed to be mandated use. And you know, if a lot of other states had done that, we'd probably be recommending that, but there's no other state that actually goes that far.
Senator Rosen?
As Dr. Reitberg said, Senator Benson, this is a compromise. This is about the only tool we have. We're not requiring use. We're requiring just to register, and it's your option whether you use it or not. Hopefully it will be used, because from Senator Eaton's information today was prescribers wrote 61.6 opioid prescriptions per 100 persons in Minnesota during 2012. That's a lot of drugs, and it just keeps getting higher and higher. So we're not, as I said, we're not mandating. We're just asking, please sign up for the program. It's your choice whether you use it or not. Hopefully it will be used, because I do think it's very important.
Would you repeat that statistic again? 61 prescriptions per 100 residents?
100 persons. 61.6 prescriptions per opioid prescriptions per 100 persons in Minnesota in 2012. And I'm sure it's much higher now.
And Senator Rosen, is that number just a number? It's just a count on the number of times a prescription was written, and it could be the same person over and over again.
And that is, Madam Chair, thank you. That's a very good question, and I think that's why it's really important to get that trend analysis and to figure out exactly what is happening, what's driving these some of this information that people in rural counties in the U.S. are nearly twice as likely to overdose on prescription painkillers as people in big cities.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to point out that if it's the statistics that were presented by the Steve Rumler Foundation, that was the number of prescriptions filled. So it wasn't necessarily the number of people who filled prescriptions.
Thank you. Senator Benson.
I just wanted to follow up then with page 3, line 15, data retained beyond 24 months must be de-identified. What level of identification do we currently maintain?
Mr. Weiberg, right into the microphone, please.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson. So currently, after the change last session, we were allowed to keep the data for 4 years. Prior to that, we could only keep it for 1 year. And actually the Senate passed language that would allow us to keep it for 4 years de-identified. And in negotiations with the House, what came out of that compromise is we could keep it for 4 years, identified for 2 years, de-identified after that. In terms of identified, it simply it has everything that's reported to us, which would be the patient's name and address, the drug, the strength of the drug, the pharmacy that dispensed it, the prescriber, the quantity dispensed, the date on which it was dispensed. The problem that we have, and we've done extensive talks with our PMP vendor on how we can do analyses, the problem that we have is actually one I think that would please folks that are worried about data privacy. We don't collect anyone's Social Security number. Therefore, we have no unique way of identifying any particular person with just one piece of data. So what we need is we need the person's first and last name and their birth date and their address at a minimum so that we can track people from year to year. At first, we thought, well, could there not be some way to just assign some sort of a code number, an encrypted number for each person in the database? But you can't do that from year to year. According to our vendor, the only way to do a trend analysis is to have enough pieces of information about the person so we can reliably try to identify that person year to year. And even then, there's going to be a little bit of work to kind of massage the data to do the trend analysis. And one of the criticisms, I'll admit, that we have faced is we have not been able to evaluate the effectiveness of the program, which we think should be done. But without having that data, we can't do it. And the sort of trend analysis we would be looking at is right now we might be able to tell very broadly if there are fewer people that appear to be doctor shopping, but what we can't know is whether it's this, you know, whether there's still a large cohort of people that are doctor shopping, and some people have fallen off, but other people have added on. We don't know that. We can just have very aggregate data at this point, aggregate estimates of how the program's working.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, if I can follow up. Dr. Weiberg, and what happens when you de-identify? Because right now you're telling me you've got first, last, the drug they were using, their address, really specific. So what does the de-identified data look like?
Mr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, it would involve removing any piece of data that could possibly identify individuals. And we actually think this would mean not just the patients, but the prescribers as well. We would remove, in the case of patients, their first and last name, their date of birth, and their address, which is the primary data that we have that would identify an individual. And then for prescribers, we would remove their name and their DEA number and their address as well.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, Dr. Weiberg, and Senator Rosen, I have some concerns about deleting this language, in particular the trend analysis. You know, if you had 50-year-old woman, rural, opioid, you know, whatever, I think you could get trends from that. And so I actually would like to look a little bit more deeply at this, or I'm sure Judiciary will look very deeply at this. But I question how long we want to retain really specific information. It makes it susceptible to, you know, people just digging around, getting themselves in trouble. It makes it really easy for it to get dumped in another database where the person had no idea their information was going to be used. Even a prescriber right now understands that this information is there, but they don't know that it's going to be shared with the Department of Health to get that 360-degree view that the Department of Health is trying to develop on people. So I want to be really careful about what we do with this going forward. I understand the need to put this program under scrutiny to make sure it's doing what it says it's going to do, but we have to be careful that we're not leaving, that we're not tempting fate for hackers and people who would do no good. So I'd appreciate another look.
Ms. Bates.
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Benson. The one thing I see when I listen to what Mr. Weiberg said is that he said he wanted to be tracking people. again, I just want to remind you what the whole point of the system was. It was not tracking people. It was allowing doctors and other prescribers to go in and make sure that they could see what the history of the person was. And so they would make prescribing decisions on the basis of that. This was not supposed to be a system of tracking people. It was supposed to be a system that would help doctors not prescribe if the doctors chose to look in. So it was supposed to be a different purpose than what I see the purpose going towards here.
Thank you. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add to this discussion, as I understand Senator Benson's concerns with the data. But, you know, addicts are quite resourceful, and they're not going to give consent, and they have been known to be quite skillful in obtaining their drug of choice. And I've seen tricks that I could spend an hour telling you. But I think it's really important that we do actually track these people to save their lives. Otherwise, we don't find them until it's too late.
Mr. Bradbrook, would you tell me again, you know, Ms. Brace is talking about the original purpose for which this concept was developed, to help prescribers see the utilization patterns of their patients and their medications, to have access for their patients to see their utilization patterns. But now we're expanding the use of this data for trends. Talk to me more about what, and you need 4-year data containment. You have it for 2 years now, and then it must be de-identified. So what is this trend that you're not able to see unless you de-identify for a longer period of time?
Madam Chair, so if we only have 2 years worth of data, all we can do is compare those 2 years. And if we de-identify data after 2 years, that's all we'll ever be able to do, is 2 years at a time. So what we won't know...
Okay, excuse me, let me make sure you're answering my question.
Yep.
So what are you looking at in those 2 years? What is it that what is it that data is telling you? What are you looking for in that trend data?
Okay, so what we're looking for is the effectiveness of the program. Does it actually make a difference? Does it reduce the level of doctor shopping? And if you have just 2 years of data, you can tell if there might be some decrease in those 2 years. But generally, if you're going to do a trend analysis, you do more than 2 years to see if that there aren't just some variations that spike back up in outlying years. So I mean, almost by definition, if you're doing a trend analysis, you need 3 or more years to see what the trend actually is. And, you know, I'm not sure if I use the word tracking or not, but I didn't mean to imply that when we're looking at this data, we're going to track individual people and then intervene. What we're trying to look at when we do the trend analysis and why we need to look at individual people is to get some idea if there is the same people that are doing the doctor shopping, or if, let's just say that the data remains flat, that if we just had de-identified data, we might say, well, there's about as many people doctor shopping each one of these years. But what we don't know when we look at that is that because it's not working at all, or are there some people who have had interventions and they've gotten into treatment, but we're picking up new people? And so it's that sort of thing. If we can't identify the data, we have no idea what sort of people we might be dealing with, whether it's the same people continuing to be abused or not.
And, Mr. Weiberg, the persons that have access to this 4-year data are whom again?
There are 4 of us, literally. Okay. Myself, my PMP manager, our PMP pharmacist and our PMP, her title is coordinator. She's our administrative assistant. And of those three, it's actually primarily the PMP pharmacist who would be doing the trend analysis, because although I might be able to do it, I don't have time to do it.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Weiberg, what you just said was that you were you needed the individual points of data so that the numbers weren't so deaggregated that you couldn't tell if you had an increase or decrease in doctor shopping, because what if people received treatment? How would you know if somebody received treatment?
Mr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, we would, looking at the data alone, what we would have to do, again, is just try to identify, maybe I did misstate this a little bit, what we're trying to identify is if it's the same people that are continuing to abuse drugs or not, whether there are groups that are increasing in abuse or not. So we couldn't really tell if someone's in treatment, for example, so that's probably a bad example. What we could do is we could tell if there were, because we have their address information, we could at least say, are there certain parts of the state where the program seems to be effective or not? We would have no intention of turning, and couldn't actually turn the data over to, say, the health department. But we could perhaps tell the health department that it looks like individuals in this part of the state, the program's not working. Is there something going on there in general that you know about at the health department that might explain that?
Just one more. This is going to go through judiciary, where data privacy is primarily the responsibility. So
I appreciate Benson. That, and I'm sorry, but I just, every time we talk about data, people say things like, and we could see if somebody went into treatment, what happened, and it just makes me think about all the stuff that people can do when they have access to data. I love data. The more data, the better, because you can do fun things with regression analysis. I get it. But you could tell the health department with de-identified data, because you could still have county information or regional information. So I want you to think really hard about what you're going to be doing with this data 3 and 4 years down the road. I know why you want to do it, and your intentions are good, but it's really easy to take a lot of information and get off track.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have to weigh in just on a couple of things. Number one, this is not going to the Department of Health. This stays in the Board of Pharmacy, and I think that should be very clear. And this is information that is extremely important, because these drugs move very, very fast. Trends and waves, and we're talking a very serious issue here with perhaps some young folks, or if they're you know, you can perhaps make a correlation, as Dr. Weiber says, there's break-ins over in some part of the state and they're stealing drugs. What's going on? I think it's an extremely important tool. I don't think there's a conspiracy method to it. The information that's being collected is very, there's really nothing there to say that it's going to be used maliciously. And we could go on and on about drug trends, because there are some other things like methamphetamine that's happening in southern Minnesota that we'll probably have to get to. But if we don't use this tool that the commissioner of the commissioner went around the state doing these substance abuse town hall meetings, and they all need this tool to at least provide them some feedback on what is happening out there, and then we can adjust. But I don't think there's any information here that couldn't be used maliciously.
Ms. Brasu, and then we'll move to a decision on the part of the committee. Ms. Brasu.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two more things. I, too, was going to contemplate the idea of knowing that somebody was doctor shopping, So if the whole idea is to do trends and to know if somebody's doctor shopping, how will this data actually prove that somebody's doctor shopping? And the other question is that Mr. Weiberg said that they won't use it against people. But let me just one more time on line 3.8, because even I wasn't sure that you quite understood my point, because line 3.8 starts at actually line 3.1, which individuals, line 3.3, no permissible user identified, blah, 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 no personnel of a state or federal occupational licensing board or agency may access the database for the purpose of obtaining information to be used to initiate or substantiate a disciplinary action against a prescriber. If you take out or substantiate, that means it can't be used to initiate, but it can be used to substantiate. And if you look at the top on page 4.20, which may or may not be your top, it's talking about someone who has engaged in activity that would constitute a crime. And so I do believe that the change in language is about going after people, and that's partially why the sections having to do with other licensing boards can give the specific complaint, and then the data can be looked at for the purpose of going after people in the database. So again, my comment is that its purpose is changing and becoming a piece of law enforcement rather than just trying to help prescribers make decisions about the utilization of their patients.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so,
Madam Chair,
this bill will be referred to Judiciary for further examination of how data is handled as private data. But we really do need to move forward, and just would highlight that this is requiring prescribers as well as pharmacists to register and maintain a user account, and it allows health licensing boards access to the data when they are investigating a specific complaint. Other licensing boards that are not health licensing would have to go through the PMP in order to have access to the data. It allows the pharmacists and prescribers to access data for medical treatments within the law, to use it for things other than this particular prescribing process, but for other other medical treatments to see and have access to the prescription history of the client. So I think that highlights it. It removes the requirement to report tramadol and to require prescriptions for gabapentin to be reported to PMP. And a provision which requires de-identifying data that's retained beyond 24 months could be retained longer. The data could still be retained no longer than 4 years, and only in the most recent 12-month data would remain accessible to permissible users as defined by the bill.
Madam
so that's
Chair.
The essence of what we're going to be moving on. Senator Nelson?
Can I just ask a quick clarifying question? The fact that medical licensing boards have access to this data, would that not help those licensing boards when, it wasn't that long ago, we had joint meetings with the House Policy and Finance Committees because we were so concerned about the revolving door that happens in these areas where some medical providers providers have access, great access to opiates. And we had cases where prescription drugs for patients were being diverted by workers. And it seems to me that this that would be an element that this particular bill would strengthen, which would really be helping to protect patients by alerting to the fact when we have medical providers who maybe are not just diverting patient drugs for personal use, but are also finding other ways to gain these highly addictive opiates. And I just want to make sure that that's part of the discussion in my mind. Is that correct?
Mr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, that's exactly correct. The language that Ms. Braze was talking about here applies really only to licensed healthcare professionals, and particularly with the oral amendment that Senator Rosen offered, the way the process would work, and we'll just use the medical board as an example, the medical board would have to get a complaint that alleges that a physician, for example, was abusing controlled substances, maybe doctor shopping themselves, maybe writing fraudulent prescriptions. They'd have to have a complaint like that. The reason for the distinction between initiate and substantiate, we don't want them to initiate it. We don't want them to go on fishing expeditions. But if they actually receive a complaint, then they would be able to use this database to really either substantiate or maybe refute it. Maybe they would find out that actually this prescriber was not doing anything wrong. So that is the purpose for this. And actually, this is coming from this is something that DHS would really like to see in this legislation, because they monitor people on Minnesota healthcare programs, and they believe, I think, that when they monitor people who might be doctor shopping, there are some worrisome, cases where there's some worrisome trends about people who are prescribing, because that's the other thing that the boards could do. If they got a complaint alleging that the physician, for example, was not obtaining the drug for themselves but was running a prescription mill and was just saying, you know, I'm going to see you and this has happened. I want to see you in a hotel room, and I'll write out a prescription for you. That's a $100 fee. And so either one of those situations, the prescriber personally abusing the drugs or the prescriber facilitating other people's abuse, there'd have to be a specific complaint before the other licensing boards could ask my staff for the data.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yes, thank you. And Senator Rosen, I'm assuming that the license boards in the professions have reviewed this and have no position or are neutral on this?
Madam Chair,
the Minnesota Medical Association.
Dr. Weaver.
Madam Chair, again, we developed this legislation in conjunction with the Prescription Monitoring Program Advisory Task Force. It has representatives of every board that licenses prescribers. It has representatives from every one of the professional associations that represents prescribers or pharmacists. The consensus was that this sort of language was okay. The degree with which the various organizations were comfortable with this language varied, but I do think, especially with this oral amendment, that I think that the professional associations are and the boards that license prescribers are okay with this going forward.
Thank you. Senator Rosen, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate File 1440 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Judiciary.
On the motion, any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Rosen, 1425.
Great. Senator... Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1425 is Alleged Drugs as Pharmaceutical Waste Collection and Disposal Provisions Modification. Basically, it changes concerning the collection and disposal of these legend drugs and pharmaceutical waste. So Section 1 basically defines the ultimate user as the patient in the nursing home. The remainder of the bill just clarifies language allowing the pharmacy to collect hazardous waste. Pharmacies must automatically assume that all drugs are hazardous pharmaceutical waste. And under current law, pharmacies can't control these controlled substance drugs. If they collect them, they must use the DEA receptacles for all controlled and non-controlled drugs. So Senate File 1425 would allow the pharmacies to collect the waste and clarify that language. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Weiberg. There is a little bit of concern that I heard just recently outside from the long-term care facilities about the piece that concerns the pollution control agency as far as how to collect theirs. Their attorneys say interpret it differently than how we're interpreting it. So I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Weiberg as far as the, that issue and let him explain further. But it just broadens the ability of the pharmacies to collect the hazardous pharmaceutical waste.
Mr. Weiber.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just very, very briefly here. The board considers this bill, the PMP bill, a separate bill that's going through on synthetic designer drugs, all to be sort of a package looking at drugs of abuse. We've heard that the PMP is a tool. It is actually not the only tool. There are many other pieces in play, some of which are actually beyond our jurisdiction, like prevention and education. What this bill would help do is we know that in addition to doctor shopping, the way that a lot of people actually get the prescription drugs that they abuse is because there are leftover drugs in the medicine cabinet. They are prescribed more than that they need, and someone in the family might steal them. There have even been cases of people coming into an open house for a real estate and rummaging through people's medicine cabinets. Minnesota is kind of blessed by having over 150 permanent collection sites in law enforcement agencies around the state. But current law does not actually allow pharmacies to set up collection receptacles to take prescription drugs back from the public for the purpose of disposing of them. And the board's worked on this issue for 2 years. We purposely waited until the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration just last fall passed federal regulations that now allow pharmacies to take even controlled substances back in two instances. They can set up really secure collection receptacles right in a retail pharmacy, or they can place those collection receptacles in a long-term care facility. When they are filled up, they can be hauled away to an incinerator and destroyed. And in theory, that has two potential advantages. One, I mentioned before, which is a decrease in drug abuse. The other one is at least some of the drugs are potentially toxic if they get in the water supply. And so there's environmental benefits as well. The bit of controversy you heard is really nothing to do with this bill, because all this bill does is simply allow pharmacies to collect these drugs, including from long-term care facilities, as long as they follow the DEA regulations. I think the concerns that the long-term care facilities and the pharmacies that specialize in long-term care pharmacy have is that they believe, and I haven't confirmed this with PCA, they believe that if they collect these drugs in the nursing homes, they're going to have to, instead of having a common carrier like UPS or something, take these drugs in these tamper-evident containers to the incinerators. They're going to have to hire hazardous waste haulers, which makes the process very expensive, according to them. It's about $800 per stop is what I've heard to have a hazardous waste hauler do this. The point they've made to me is if these prescription drugs, when they order them from a drug wholesaler, can be shipped by UPS to the pharmacy, why is it that they would have to go from the pharmacy to the incinerator by a hazardous waste hauler? So that's what the concern is, but that really isn't an issue with this bill. This bill simply allows pharmacies to collect the waste. The issue, if any, would come with whatever the current Pollution Control Agency statutes and regs are about how they have to be transported.
Is there any question or discussion on the bill?
Madam Chair, my intent is to continue to working with the long-term care group and making sure that we can. And there's actually really no language that can be brought into this to give them comfort, but we'll continue to work on this. But I think
is
it's
there
a good
anyone
bill.
Else
I think
that
it was
wishes
well stated, too.
I failed to ask Senator Rose. Is there anyone else here this evening that wishes to speak to this bill? I just have one quick question, then we need to move on. But I understand that this would allow pharmacies to collect these drugs for disposal.
Mm-hmm.
But what controls are there over how, you know, if I can collect from a nursing home that has a rehab center and the person's on an opioid or a narcotic for pain after knee replacement or hip surgery, and there are unused medications there, How is that recorded and documented to make sure that what is unused is not sort of redirected in transport or at some place along the line?
Right. Madam Chair, the DEA regulations that are in place are pretty stringent.
Without going into the details, are there provisions that are controlling counting these and signing off and two people watching at the same time or any of those kinds of things that make it secure?
That would be in the nursing home, yes. There are existing regulations enforced by the health department that licenses the long-term care facilities that would require, right now what would happen is, say, two nurses would witness the destruction together, and what they would do to destroy it, what they traditionally have done, is sewer it, put it down the sink. Now what they would do is they would still have to witness the destruction, but what happened is it would go into these DEA-approved receptacles. They wouldn't have the locks to those, and they're built a lot like the old-fashioned blue mailboxes are. Once you put it in, if you try to get it out again, you can't get your hand down in there to get anything back out. And then what would happen is there'd have to be two people that would witness the removal of the bag, and it's sealed, and it's tamper-evident, not tamper-proof, but it's tamper-evident, and then it's transported. And then when it's transported when it's dumped or taken to the dump, basically, taken to the incinerator, the folks there would have to look to see if there's any evidence of tampering. So there are safeguards built into place.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Senator Rosen, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that Senate File 1425 be recommended pass.
And goes to the floor.
And goes to the floor. Thank you, Madam Chair.
On the motion, any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those say nay. Passes. Thank you. Senator
Thank
Lori.
You, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Oh, boy.
Madam Chair, and
thank you, Senator Lori.
I have Senate File 1694, last on the agenda tonight. And I'll just start by saying this is a really, really difficult and emotional issue that I bring before you, and I take it incredibly seriously. It has rose to the forefront because of some local circumstances as of late, but that have a history in my region and likely in other places around the state. There's been a lot of attention in the last month or so to two incidences of tribal members that have been taken by the medical examiner in St. Louis and Carlton counties and held against the family's wishes with apparently no real compelling state interest to try to perform these autopsies, and the families were put in a situation where they had to go and get a court order to allow the families to recover the bodies of their deceased family and loved ones. And a couple of days there where the medical examiner attempted to ignore the court order even and not return the bodies. And this goes back, I mean, I remember 20 years ago in our region, tribal members having to intervene, and they actually took it upon themselves to break into the medical examiner's office and steal a tribal elder and abscond with them. And it was a really difficult, charged issue. And as we review the statutes, right now there is absolutely unfettered ability for this unelected official to make a decision as to whether or not to perform an autopsy and the extent of that autopsy, and it's become fairly difficult. In Minnesota, we have a constitutional right to practice religion. And when state action interferes with that practice of religion, our Constitution calls for a balancing test, and you need a compelling state interest in order to intervene. So I don't take this lightly. I've heard many concerns. We're trying to work with folks, and I know that in members' packets they have kind of the seminal case on the balancing test from the Hershberger case, where that was set out, where, you know, when we have this compelling state interest weighed against religious freedoms, you need to demonstrate that it is indeed a compelling state interest. And for these instances that I'm talking about, we were clearly the other side of compelling state interest. These two deaths, neither of which did law enforcement have a concern with, neither of which did the hospitals and the medical folks have a concern with and flag as something that needed further work, and the medical examiner had a different opinion and had, complete authority to try to do that, and it put these families through a great deal of pain. And they were successful in having the bodies returned in order to perform their religious practice upon death. And there's probably no more ceremonially shrouded practice than what we do with our deceased loved ones. And so, again, it is a very difficult issue. I will step you through the bill as briefly as I can, but what it really does is it provides for a religious objection to autopsies and tries to tease out what that compelling state interest would be, that absolutely we need an autopsy. And so Sections 1 and 2 modify the section to provide for religious objections. Section 3 creates the religious objection, and that's where most of it is. Paragraph A defines the following terms: compelling state interest, interested party, religious beliefs, religious grounds, and surviving relatives. Compelling state interest is the one to pay attention to. Maybe I'll ask, I don't know if the A3 amendment has been passed out. It can be at this point. And we have made some changes in that, but I'll keep going through the bill and then we'll move the A3 author's amendment when we get there. Paragraph B in Section 3 requires a coroner or medical examiner at least 24 hours before performing a dissection or autopsy to give written notice to the surviving relative of the decedent of the surviving relative's right to object to the dissection or autopsy on religious grounds. The dissection or autopsy must not be performed if a surviving relative objects on religious grounds unless there is that compelling state interest. And a coroner or medical examiner may require the surviving relative to present an affidavit stating the person's relationship to the decedent, the religious affiliation of the decedent, that the decedent has a religious objection and the basis of the belief, and that the surviving relative will assume responsibility for the lawful disposition of the body of the deceased. Paragraph C, still in Section 3, states that if a coroner or medical examiner determines that there is a compelling state interest to perform a dissection or autopsy, and the surviving relative objects on religious grounds, or an interested party objects and submits written information showing reason to believe that it would be contrary to the religious beliefs of the decedent, the dissection or autopsy must not be performed for at least 48 hours after notice of the dissection or autopsy was given to the objecting party. The objecting party may bring an action in district court to determine the propriety of the dissection or autopsy, and the court may waive the waiting period upon an ex parte motion if the court determines that a delay would prejudice the accuracy of the dissection or autopsy. And paragraph D permits a coroner or medical examiner to bring an action in district court for an order to authorize the dissection or autopsy if the coroner or medical examiner determines that there is a compelling state interest under circumstances not provided for in the definition of compelling state interest, and there has been an objection based on religious grounds by a surviving relative or an interested party, and the party has submitted the required written information. The action may be brought by a notice to show cause served on the surviving relative or, if not available, on another party as directed by the court, and the proceeding must be determined summarily on the oral and written proof submitted by the parties. The court would be required to grant relief sought if it finds that the coroner or medical examiner has established a demonstrable need for the dissection or autopsy that outweighs observing the decedent's religious beliefs. If the court denies the petition, the body must be immediately released for burial to the surviving relative. And finally, paragraph E specifies that any dissection or autopsy performed based on a compelling state interest when a religious objection has been made must be the least intrusive, consistent with that compelling state interest. So that's the bill, and I do have the author's amendment, the A3 amendment. I can step through it because we have had quite a few people interested in trying to work on this issue. The first, does everyone have the A3 amendment?
We all so have I'll the move A3 it amendment.
Have it in front of us. And the first section is MDH language and negotiation with stakeholders, making sure that every coroner medical examiner has a statement of policy or principles to be used for communicating with surviving relatives. So MDH worked that one out. The next section from lines 1.9 to 1.14 is also from MDH and working with the stakeholders, and it's really taking the public health threat that is part of the compelling state interest and splitting it into two, one focusing on the public health threat and the second protecting the public's health. Line 1.15 is technical renumbering. Line 1.16 is from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, where on line 3.28 of the bill it says if the specimens may represent evidence of a crime and if that evidence will deteriorate over time, this changes it to if it may deteriorate over time for a little bit lower standard to allow for that test. 1.17 is technical again. 1.18 and 19 is the case involving children, which is actually I did get the national standards that medical examiners follow, and the case involving a child, an unexpected and unexplained death of a child, should always be autopsied because there's often issues discovered there. And Children's Hospital has raised an issue with this. Child welfare advocates have raised an issue with this. And so in working with stakeholders, I was convinced that the case of children is special, and that's what this one's in here for. And then also partially responding to some of the medical examiner's concerns on lines 120 to 122, nothing in this section prohibits the coroner or medical examiner from, you know, working with the family to obtain voluntary permission and talking about the benefits that might accrue to the family from having the certainty that delivered by an autopsy. So that's the A3 amendment. I renew my motion.
Senator Lurie offers the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. With that, I will. I think there's a few people who wish to testify. Open it up to questions or testimony, whatever the committee's preference is.
Are there any questions at this time? Seeing none, we could proceed with testimony. First that we have listed here is Jason Adkins, Executive Director, Minnesota Catholic Conference. Welcome, Mr. Adkins. And who else is here?
This is Tad Johnson.
And Tad Johnson, who's the Professor of Indian Studies with the University of Minnesota Duluth. Thank you. So, Mr. Adkins, you will be first?
Hey, Tad Johnson.
Madam
Chair, may Tad...
Are you Tad Johnson?
No, this is Tad. I'm Jason.
Introduce yourself and please begin your testimony.
Me first. Okay, sorry.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tad Johnson. I'm a professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth. I'm also an attorney. In a previous life, I was staff director and counsel to the U.S. House Subcommittee on Native American Affairs. Madam Chair, the majority of Americans live in jurisdiction wherein people can make religious freedom objections to autopsies. The way this legislation reads, the family simply gets an opportunity to object to an autopsy if it violates their sincerely held religious beliefs. This bill does not impede the investigation or prosecution of a crime. It does not prevent autopsies, and all existing reasons for doing autopsies remain in place. Under the bill, if the state can show a compelling interest, criminal investigations, public health reasons as delineated in the law, the autopsy will go forward. The standard for this is low in the bill. So if they really want an autopsy, they could get one. The incident I was directly involved in, there was a 65-year-old Native American man named Mashkoub Abed with a history of heart disease. I had known him and his family for nearly 30 years. I'd been their tribal attorney, and I'm also a member of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe. Mashkoub had been in a car accident, but the state patrol did not request an autopsy. He died in the hospital. The hospital did not request an autopsy. Only the medical examiner was seeking an autopsy. The family objected to the autopsy. Mr. Abed was a fervent believer in a form of religion that's unique to Ojibwe people called the Medewin, or the Grand Medicine Society. He was a fourth-degree Mede. He was also a drum keeper, so he was a spiritual leader of the tribe. The medical examiner did not talk to the family. It was learned that the autopsy was to be performed at 3 p.m. on Sunday. Another attorney and I, and I'm a college professor and I don't do much law stuff, but we had to rush to write a court order and a memorandum of law and find a judge that day. The autopsy was delayed, but we obtained a court order at 11 p.m. on Sunday night at Judge McCauley's home in Cloquet. At midnight, we returned to Duluth where the body was. The medical examiner was on a speakerphone. She was not present. I told her I had a court order, and this conversation was witnessed by two police officers on speakerphone. She told me no court order applied. I told her I could call 911. She told me to go ahead because the police would be on her side. Rather than causing a scene, I went out and told the widow of Mr. Abed I had the court order, but I could not get the body. Under the Medewin belief, the family is supposed to be as close to the body as possible. In fact, they were supposed to be washing the body with cedar and water that night. They were not allowed to do so. The body was locked in a room and guarded by police officers. So I had to go tell her that I had a court order, but she could not have the body. The body could not get released. The order provided that the family was supposed to get the body. She did not understand, and neither did I. In order to stay close to the body, the family stood outside all night. The weather that night was about 15 degrees. With wind chill, it was probably around zero. The following morning, the Fond du Lac attorney and I met with a St. Louis County attorney who called the Carlton County attorney, and the incident had taken place in Carlton County. Ultimately, the body was released very reluctantly by the medical examiner. Together, the two county attorneys had to convince the medical examiner to release the body. In subsequent conversations with the county sheriffs and the county attorneys, it was clear to me that the law was vague. The thinking on their part was that once the autopsy statute kicked in, the medical examiner had the exclusive right to the body. To them, it was not clear if a court order even applied. 3 days later, and this obviously concerned us, but 3 days later, the exact same thing happened to a 24-year-old Fond du Lac woman. She died. Her family objected to an autopsy based on her Medewin beliefs. And I was told by the Fond du Lac attorney that the medical examiner, again, did not talk to the family. As they were taking the body, a police officer told the medical examiner that she had to tell the family where she was taking the body because the family wanted to know. The Fond du Lac attorney told me the medical examiner said the body was going to Hibbing and the family would have 1 hour to get a court order or the autopsy would begin. In short, she would start cutting. The family was devastated. A second court order was obtained. Again, the body was turned over to the family, but that was only after the county attorney and the county sheriff called the medical examiner and spent an hour on the phone trying to convince him to release the body. The Medevin religion is not well known. It went underground when it was a federal policy for Indians to not practice their religion or speak their language. The medical examiner of St. Louis County and Carlton County, same person, had not heard of the Medevin, and he did not believe it existed. Hence, even when attorneys obtained a court order to return the body to the family, the sheriff and the county's attorneys were not sure what to do. That's the problem. The view was expressed to us several times that once the body was released to the medical examiner under the statute, the county attorneys and law enforcement did not know if a court order applied. We are here to clarify this law. The law gives everyone a day in court, which is what everyone wanted. The county attorney, the medical examiner, the family, everybody wanted their day in court. We got ex parte orders because the medical examiners were moving so fast towards the autopsies that we had to go to a judge and get an ex parte order because they were going to cut into the body so quickly. It gives a medical examiner a chance to state their case as well as the family of the deceased to state their case. In this state, whether a family is Jewish, Christian Scientist, or Medewin, they would have a right guaranteed under the First Amendment and the Minnesota State Constitution to the free exercise of their religion. They can make a request to the court under this bill based on their religious belief to have the body returned to the family so that they can mourn in their traditional way. In this instance, the family was not allowed to do so. But this law would apply across the board to all faiths, which I believe our next gentleman will address. I'm willing to entertain any questions from the committee.
Thank you. Why don't we hear the next testifier, Mr. Adkins.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jason Adkins. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, which is the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota. I'm also here tonight representing the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, of which the Minnesota Catholic Conference is a sponsor and of which I serve as a board member. The Joint Religious Legislative Coalition is comprised of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas, the Minnesota Council of Churches, and the Islamic Center of Minnesota. You've received letters in your packets from some of our member organizations. Now, some Muslims, some Jews, other people of faith have objections to autopsies. This issue extends beyond the Native American community. But we're here this evening to speak to a broader principle. Our churches, our faith communities, believe that religious liberty is an essential human right and an important component of ensuring the dignity of each human person to respond to his or her call of the Creator consistent with their conscience, and that should not be unreasonably burdened by the government. Throughout American history, religious liberty has been an important value, our first freedom, and affirmed in culture and law. It's not a Christian value or a Jewish value or a Muslim value. It's an American value. The U.S. Supreme Court has incorporated the protections of the First Amendment against state and local governments to ensure the free exercise primarily of minority religions and viewpoints in what has been historically a predominantly Christian nation. In doing so, the court required that laws imposing burdens on religion must satisfy a compelling governmental interest, not just any old interest, and must be the least religiously restrictive means of meeting that government interest. Unfortunately, when the U.S. Supreme Court abandoned that test in 1990, Minnesota, the Minnesota Supreme Court in the Hirschberger decision that Senator Lori mentioned, we led the way in rejecting the Supreme Court's new and, we think, unfortunate standard for protecting religious liberty and put the compelling interest test affirmatively in our state constitution because of the importance the state of Minnesota places on the free exercise of religion. If that's the case, if our Minnesota Constitution is so robust in its protection of religious liberty, one might ask then, why is this law, which also imposes a compelling interest standard in the context of autopsies, be needed? What statutory religious accommodations do, such as the one proposed in this law, is to make clear to government officials that they may not burden religious liberty in a particular context, as in this case autopsies, or perhaps in burial practices,
absent a compelling interest. One shouldn't have to go to court to defend one's rights, and that we should be able to rely on government officials to respect the Constitution. Now, of course, in many instances, legislators and the government and government officials do, of course, respect our Constitution, but as you've heard, sometimes they don't. Most importantly, legislative accommodations for religious liberty allow the legislative process to diffuse such potential conflicts and conserve judicial resources by drawing reasonable lines of accommodation between the sometimes competing interests of the broader public and religious believers. Religious liberty is decidedly not a license to do whatever you want. It is subject to the common good. This legislation proposed today embodies the possibilities for drawing reasonable lines of accommodation between the important public interests of protecting religious liberty and ensuring the information gathering process of an autopsy can be a service to the important governmental interest of solving crime. The proposed law defines compelling interest broadly to ensure that medical examiners have the ability to perform autopsies when the public necessity requires it. There need only be, for example, a suspicion, not evidence, that the decedent was a victim of crime. Toxicological specimens, for example, may be procured from the decedent on the mere possibility that they may represent evidence of a crime. Now, undoubtedly, medical examiners in some cases have good protocols in place. And in fact, I've spoken with Mr. Baker, who will be testifying tonight, and he seems to be very well regarded, as is his office, is applying some of the best protocols and standards in terms of medical examinations and autopsies. Still, and I know this was distributed to you moments ago by the Hennepin County, I want to point your attention to one provision. It says, can a family refuse an autopsy? Now, let me say, this is a really helpful and informative guide, and I think consistent with what we've heard about the very fine practices in Hennepin County. But even here, there lies an ambiguity in which we think this piece of legislation might fix. It says, can a family refuse an autopsy? It says, Minnesota law does not recognize a right to refuse an autopsy ordered by the medical examiner. Now, this is true, perhaps, in a technical sense. And, of course, we can't rely on government officials to say, oh, you can have recourse to the state constitution and sue us. We shouldn't expect that they're going to counsel people to sue them if they don't like the response. And, of course, they acknowledge that you can have a discussion with us about this. But perhaps a statute like this might give clear direction to both persons and government officials about what standards should apply in this particular context. I think there's an ambiguity here that could be addressed, particularly for people's information and how they can exercise these important values. Now, we recognize that protecting civil rights can place limitations on government actors, but that is the whole point of a Bill of Rights in our state and federal constitutions, that limits the power of government in certain circumstances to protect important and fundamental values. We are here today, however, because religious liberty is an important value worth protecting, even when it can be an inconvenience sometimes to government officials, or in this case, medical examiners. Creating a statutory framework to address these issues is a reasonable way of accommodating the public's interest in both protecting the free exercise of religion and in ensuring that autopsies continue to be an important tool of investigation in the criminal context. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This bill, of course, will be going to judiciary, where a number of these legal issues that you're describing and focused on will be addressed. This is the Health and Human Services Policy Committee, so I think a particular interest to this group would be, while paying attention to the conversation that Senator Lori, you're addressing in terms of legal rights, especially the right to religious traditions and expressions and the right to make decisions based on that, that we make sure that in relationship to the bill that we do not eliminate what might be in the public health's interest, which is to always determine the cause of death, but if there are health issues, contagions, other kinds of concerns to the area of public health. And in your amendment, you have addressed those things very specifically, including potential public health threat, and that's why you determine and ascertain the manner of death, dissection that is determining an underlying disease in order to protect the public's health. That's the interest of this committee. And, of course, cases involving unexpected or unexplained death of a child around the issues of child protection. And so I'm just, to the testifiers, would assure you that a lot of the legal things that you're talking about here will be reviewed in a committee that can really dissect that, autopsy that substantially. Mm-hmm. But in this committee, we need to be assured that along with these rights that Senator Lori is wanting to make certain are in place, that we don't move to the other end of the spectrum where we do not allow a process to occur that assures the public's health. So I just would remind you that we would be listening for testimony about that. So the next testifier is Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to ask a question of the testifiers. Sure. Briefly. Someone who has strong belief in religious liberty, as I think we all do, I would like to know if the testifiers, in my opinion, it sounded like in the history that Mr. Johnson gave that maybe there was a rogue medical examiner who was just either unaware or not listening. And my question would be, if in fact there were a requirement that someone in addition to the medical examiner would need to certify these conditions that are in the A3 amendment, if that would be helpful in further protecting religious liberty without negating the public health risks or the crime analysis risk. So I'm asking about the having someone in addition to the medical examiner certify why the autopsy is needed.
Senator Lori?
Madam Chair, I'm Senator Nelson. I'm kind of struggling with understanding your question. Are you suggesting another entity to perform the balancing test,
nope,
compelling state interest versus religious liberties? And I'm not sure who you're suggesting that entity might be.
So, Madam Chair? So my question actually was to the testifiers, that if there were someone in addition to the medical examiner, maybe it was the sheriff's department or the county attorney or the hospital, someone in addition to just the medical examiner ordering the autopsy, if that would provide further protections for religious liberty.
Would you say your name, please?
Madam Chair, Gail Kulik, Government Relations with Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. And in answer to Senator Nelson's question, there are several states that require either a state chief medical examiner to weigh in or the county or district attorney in addition to make that determination. What we were looking for as my client stakeholders in this case is someone of neutrality, and that would be a court who did not have a stake in the outcome, who was not going to be the prosecutor or the medical examiner, so that the interests of the family whose religious faith was, you know, in their mind under threat would be balanced.
Yes, and Ms. Kulik, it is in the court then that the medical examiner would have to demonstrate that the need for autopsy existed on the basis of the need for an understanding of the public health threat that might exist or any of these reasons that would justify an autopsy even in the face of a religious objection. And that determination would be made in this bill in a court.
Correct.
And that occurs within the first 48 hours is the right to... wasn't there Senator Lori language about that?
Madam Chair, in a situation where the medical examiner believed that either because of the condition of the body or other conditions that a shorter timeline was demanded, the medical examiner can go alone, we call it ex parte, to the court and have that waiting period eliminated or at least reduced. I can certainly think of epidemiological cases where if there was something incredibly contagious going around that was causing death, and it's an adult because we've already dealt with children, that would be one of those cases where there is a compelling state interest, and that would
overbalance the religious freedom. And so that's why this bill defines compelling state interest. And in fact, we are still in the process of, as Senator Lori said, taking in information from other stakeholders to even better define compelling state interest.
Okay, thank you. There are other testifiers. Gail. Oh, that was Gail. Okay, thank you, Gail. And then Dr. Andrew Baker. Welcome, Dr. Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I apologize if I'm a little nervous. This is not the usual arena for a medical examiner or a physician to be in. My name is Andrew Baker, and I'm the chief medical examiner for Hennepin, Dakota, and Scott counties. I'm guessing everyone on this committee knows what it takes to be a medical examiner in Minnesota, but in the off chance that you don't, it does require a four-year medical degree, does require 3 to 5 years of subspecialized training in all fields of pathology, and an additional year of forensic pathology training. To be the chief medical examiner in my county and the counties I serve also requires that you be board certified by the American Board of Pathology. Minnesota has among the most stringent requirements to be a medical examiner in the United States, and I'm very proud to uphold those standards. I've been practicing as a forensic pathologist at federal and regional level for 17 years. It strikes me that the reasons we are here this evening center on issues of listening, respect, and compromise. I truly believe we can find a way to address the issues that got us here tonight without wholesale changes to a law that, with the glaring exceptions you heard about earlier, has actually served Minnesota well for decades. I came here tonight planning to speak about the rationale for autopsies, the scientific basis for postmortem examinations, the big picture of public health, and the practice of medicine. But I've come to realize that those are not really what the push for this bill is about. And while I cannot claim to personally know the depth of insult, which is entirely understandable, suffered by some of those supporting this bill, I do hope to offer you a different, optimistic, and cooperative approach. When I go out and speak to the community at large, I always close with the point that families are the most important people that medical examiners serve. Not the police, not the county attorneys, not the media. It's families. Providing families answers is what we do. Legislation that frames concerns about autopsies as an adversarial situation will ultimately add to a family's grief when they are immediately placed at odds with, rather than being served by, their medical examiner's office. And in Minnesota, most medical examiners have a long record of building bridges with the cities, the counties, the tribes, and the communities that we serve. I do not question that this legislation was crafted and offered with the best of intentions. And on another day, at another time, I may readily discuss the unintended medical, legal, and social consequences of such a bill. But today, let me offer a different approach. Let's bring all parties to the table. We have models for building cultural competence, and we can work together to improve our service. Many offices, and now I speak for Ramsey, Anoka, Mayo Clinic, and the Grand Forks Medical Examiner Office, already have policies that ensure open lines of communication with families. If families have concerns for any reason, we are always willing to try to find common ground so that families know their concerns were heard and their needs respected, and we have fulfilled our statutory obligation to the larger community. My office publicly states that we recognize that your family beliefs may be contrary to autopsy. We are open to discussion to try to accommodate your wishes as long as we can fulfill the legal obligation presented by your loved one's death. We can and we have built systems that stretch from the Iowa border to Grand Forks, North Dakota, in which families know they have been listened to and respected. This is the same model that most other states have, laws that acknowledge the dedication, professionalism, and medical judgment of their medical examiners, while simultaneously allowing those medical examiners the flexibility and compassion to work with families of every imaginable social, ethnic, cultural, or religious background. I urge you not to take a series of instances from one office and generalize it to statewide legislation that would change the practice of medicine. Build on what the best offices have already done. Ensure continuing education for medical examiners and coroners where it is needed on issues of culture, heritage, religion, and tradition. Take the best models the best offices have already developed and use them as a foundation for a larger, better, and more inclusive system. All coroner and medical examiner offices should have written policies and office procedures that address family, community, tribal, religious, cultural, or other concerns pertaining to death investigations and autopsies. And those policies should point families to the legal system in a judicial remedy if no middle ground can be found. In the 17 years that I have been doing this, I have never had an instance where I could not find a middle ground with a family such that we ended up standing in open court debating whether any sort of examination was really necessary. No one now running a medical examiner office in Minnesota can oppose such an approach, because for most of us, it's how we've always practiced, and we would not want anything to come between us and the families we serve. And I do just want to go off script for one moment, because we've been having some very fruitful conversations in the hall, and I think I can speak for most of the stakeholders in the room when I say we are going to meet at my office tomorrow at 10 o'clock to try to wrap our heads around what exactly is a compelling state interest and how does that fit with the nationally accepted standards of medical examiners from coast to coast. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Are there any questions for this testifier?
I got a question.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Lori, for bringing this bill. And Dr. Baker, I know that we've had some conversations about this issue, especially as it relates to immigrant communities or communities that may be lower income or lower educated, in terms of them trying to figure out how to get through this process. I do have a question in that. I know that we talked about the cultural competency of your office and your examiners and others. Dr. Baker, does this form come in any other language other than English?
Madam Chair, Senator, to my knowledge, it does not.
Dr. Baker? I have to go through here. It's okay. I'll just acknowledge you, and then you can present. Dr. Baker.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden.
Yep.
Thank
That's
you.
Right.
Thank you.
Talk
for the
about
question.
The rules that govern you.
To my knowledge, Senator, currently the brochure does not exist in other languages. That is why I have in the field death investigators who are working directly with the family as my representatives. I understand that even to English speakers, sometimes language in a medical document can be confusing. That's why in my office we have a policy of starting at the lowest level and working our way up. And what I mean by that is if a family has any objections they express to my investigator, and we ask, are you comfortable with an autopsy? And we explain, this is what the process is going to be. They work with my investigator as their interface with our system.
So Dr. Baker, I just, in the interest of time.
Senator Hayden.
So thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't mean to cut you off, Dr. Baker, but I guess I'm just trying to get at the cultural competency aspect of your office. So, for instance, if you don't have brochures in other languages, because we're dealing with a lot of, especially in, you know, the districts I represent, do you have investigators that you speak about that are diverse? Is there a diverse pool of investigators? Do you have Muslim and other investigators, or in this case, maybe more from an ethnic standpoint, a Somali investigator, a Latino investigator? How does that pool of investigators and folks that interact with the public look like in your office?
Dr. Baker.
Madam Chair, Senator, thank you for the question. I don't know the religious backgrounds of my investigators. I wasn't aware that I could legally ask that. I am peripherally aware of some of their ethnicities by my best estimation. The best I can tell you is that we do have an investigator, at least one, that is fluent in Spanish. In most other circumstances, even we, being the largest ME office in the country, are still a very small staff. And so when needed, we will bring in translators for virtually any language we may need to work with. We may effect that through Hennepin County Medical Center or through one of our law enforcement agencies, depending on where we can get the best interpreter in the quickest amount of time.
So, Madam Chair and Dr.
Senator
Baker,
Hayden.
I appreciate that. I think that as part of your deliberations tomorrow when you meet and have a conversation on how to get this bill through, I think one of the things that you also can do after that is to start to look at that and to start to figure out how those practices could work and that things have evolved. I know that we've had a conversation, and I'm confident that your intentions are phenomenal, that your agency does a great job, but that sometimes is not good enough in terms of the work that we need to do and the sensitivity, not just simply the linguistic issues that we are, aspect that we may have with people, but also a better understanding of the culture in which people come from. So, Senator Lori and other stakeholders, I would hope that when you meet tomorrow and you're working through this bill, you'll be in judiciary at some point, that you continue to have an open mind about what this bill would do. But also, Doctor, and your colleagues throughout the state, to take a look at our changing demographics. Some people have just been here forever, right? Like our Native American folks that were here before everybody else, but also our new immigrants, and to make sure that our practice and how we hire and how we interact with people are not only linguistically correct, but they're culturally relevant to them as well.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Baker. It sounds like you run an exemplary office, and I want to commend you for making efforts that keep you from being in conflict. And as this bill goes forward, I would like you to help the members of the legislature understand how this would interfere with you doing that good work. Because unfortunately, many times when we legislate, it's not because there is a blanket problem, but because there are specific problems that have led to legislation. And we want to avoid doing damage to a system like yours that appears to be working. However, we also need to clearly communicate that the religious liberties of the citizens involved in some of these unfortunate cases must take precedent unless there is a compelling public health interest. And so I hope that as you convene tomorrow, you keep in mind that you try to build something that is ideal, and we have to deal with the exceptions. And so, Madam Chair, are there other questions?
Were you going to make a motion?
I was going to move.
I would just like to offer Senator Lurie the opportunity. Did you have an amendment or something?
No.
No, Senator Lurie can offer the bill,
okay.
His own bill. But I'll go back to saying that we're talking about constitutional rights, the right to religious expression and freedom, and a number of other judicial processes in order to make certain that that if there's a disagreement about what takes priority, that there's a method for that to be resolved. That's what's in this bill. And you're going to have a conversation about how you might construct things a little differently before it comes to judiciary. But if it's leaving this committee, I am on judiciary, and I will be there because I will continue to pay attention to what this committee has to have as a primary responsibilities to make certain that those public health needs, the public information about infectious diseases, causes of death, trends, that kind of information is important for us to have in order to assure the public safety, and that whatever the final outcome is, that it balances and makes certain that those components are understood and met in this legislation, that you don't lose the capacity to do those responsibilities in this legislation. Did you want to say something for? I saw Dr. Baker that you looked like you were leaning forward and saying something, but if not, yep. We can move ahead with the bill. Senator Lurie?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to acknowledge how much I appreciate you recognizing the public health aspect of this issue. I am eager for the stakeholders to meet tomorrow. I think in the Venn diagram of what I as a physician and a medical examiner find important and what the stakeholders think are compelling state interests, I think there's a lot more room for overlap than exists in the current iteration of the bill, and I'm certainly looking forward to exploring that tomorrow. Obviously, the more overlap we find, the less constrained medical examiners will feel that there's been a legislative infringement on the practice of medicine. Again, always acknowledging the overarching issue of if families have concerns, we will do everything we can to address those. I would like to dot one last I, if I could. I am very sensitive to the issue of cultural competence because I don't particularly in my own life have a tremendously diverse background. I'd like to believe that you could get many of the religious leaders from the Twin Cities that I've worked with over the years in communities that I don't normally interact with to come in here, and they could tell you how well they've been able to work with our office. Even if I don't necessarily speak the family's language or share their faith background, we work very closely with the people that are advising those families to look for common ground. There are simply always ways to find common ground if you're creative and flexible and willing to do it. Thank you.
Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, I'm glad to hear the stakeholders are meeting tomorrow. I will make sure I stay engaged, and I want to assure everyone I want to get this right. This is a really difficult issue. I don't want to bowl through the wrong law just because we have a terrible story behind us. So I look forward to continued discussions, and I move that Senate File 1694, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Any further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion passes. Thank you very much, Senator Lori, and to all the testifiers for waiting so long. And we are adjourned.